The next morning, Sally was strong enough to be moved from the doctor's office to Tamara's small house on the edge of town. She was put on a stretcher and carried 2 blocks to Tamara's one-room cabin. When they reached Tamara's cabin, the stretcher bearers, 2 young men hired by Smoke for the job, took her inside and put her on the bed. There could be no greater contrast between Sally's fine house at Sugarloaf, a 2-story edifice with 5 bedrooms, a living room, parlor, dining room, and kitchen, and Tamara's tiny abode. The house was 1 room with a bed, a table, and 2 chairs, a cooking heating stove, and a small settee. There was also a cot where Tamara said she'd be sleeping during Sally's convalescence. Dr. Gunther had walked down with his patient as well, and as Sally was moved gently from the litter to the bed, he put the back of his hand on her forehead. He looked over at Tamara.
I'm going to leave you a thermometer so you can take her temperature from time to time. There are 2 things we need to look out for. Shock and infection.
How do I look out for them?
If there is a change in her alertness, if she starts having dizzy spells, quick, shallow breathing, or clammy skin, those would be signs of shock. I think she is past that danger, but one should always be careful.
What do I do if she has shock?
If you think she's going into shock, lift her legs so that they're higher than her head, and keep her warm.
All right.
There may be a greater danger of infection, so I want you to look out for it as well. Her wound will probably start suppurating or draining. If the liquid that comes out is clear, there's no problem. That is to be expected. But if it looks like pus or has an odor, or if you see little red streaks on the skin leading away from the wound, that would indicate infection. Then I want you to take her temperature. If it is over 101 degrees, that is absolute evidence that her wound has become infected.
And if that happens?
Treat the wound with iodine. In fact, if you keep the wound treated, I think the likelihood of infection will be remote. In fact, if you keep the wound treated, I think the likelihood of infection will be remote. I will leave you 2 bottles, along with the thermometer.
Thank you.
Smoke sent Cal back to Sugarloaf to help Pearlie with the spring roundup. Over the next week, he developed a routine. Every morning, he walked down to Tamara's house to have breakfast with Sally and her friend. He would sit beside Sally's bed, talking to her, sometimes reading to her while she was awake, remaining quiet as she slept. At night, he slept in the hotel room. On the 3rd day, Sally developed an infection. At first, it was just some red lines radiating out from the wound, but then her temperature rose to 102. Dr. Gunther was called. He cleaned and disinfected the wound and kept a wet cloth on her face. For 2 days, Sally hovered between life and death. Smoke stayed in the little house with her, talking to her, reassuring her when she was conscious that everything was going to be all right. But was it? During Sally's periods of unconsciousness, Smoke slept fitfully. When Smoke awakened from his troubled sleep, it was dark in the little house, the only light being the soft silver splash of moonlight spilling in through the window. He got up from the settee and walked quietly over to the bed. Reaching down, he put the back of his hand on Sally's forehead. Where it had been hot for the last 3 days, now it was cool. Her fever had broken, and the infection was stopped.
You're going to live. You're going to live.
Oh, Smoke, what a pleasant surprise. Have you been here long?
Not too long. How do you feel?
I feel fine. It doesn't even hurt anymore.
Good.
Smoke, tomorrow, I would like to go back to Sugarloaf.
We'll see what the doctor says.
Let me reword that. Tomorrow, I'm going back to Sugarloaf.
Well, with that attitude, I'm pretty sure you will.
Were you thinking about Nicole?
What?
Nicole was killed. I know how you grieved over her. Were you afraid that was going to happen to you again?
I gave it some thought.
You needn't have worried. Nicole came to visit me. She told me that everything was going to be all right.
What do you mean, Nicole came to visit you?
Well, she was here tonight. I was talking to her just right before you woke me up. Oh, Oh, I guess what I meant to say was I dreamed about her tonight. You loved her very much, didn't you?
Yes, but...
You don't need any buts. She was your wife. Don't you know that your capacity to love is one of the things that I love most about you?
Smoke picked up Sally's hand and kissed it.
There you go again, kissing my hand like I'm some grand dame in the Queen's court. You can do better than that.
Smoke leaned down and kissed her full on the mouth. A telegram brought Pearlie over from Big Rock. Dr. Gunther had given Sally permission to go home, provided she not be jostled about too much. When Pearlie arrived, he was driving a grand carriage.
Hello, Miss Sally.
Hello, Pearlie. My, what an elegant carriage. Wherever did you get such a thing?
Ain't she a beaut, though? The seats inside is all red velvet, and if you get cold, well, all you got to do is close the windows. This belongs to the governor.
The governor?
Yes, ma'am. The governor had the carriage brought to Big Rock, because he wanted Elmer Baker to touch up the gold trim for him. He'd done a real good job, too, didn't he? Look at how that gold is shining.
At that moment, one of the doors opened, and Dr. Colton, the doctor from Big Rock, stepped down.
Dr. Colton, what are you doing here?
I got a telegram from Smoke. He told me you were coming home today and asked if I didn't think it'd be a pretty good idea if I came along to ride back with you.
Smoke, you know I'm fine. Why did you bother him like that?
Believe me, Sally, it is no bother. I consider it an honor. In fact, Lewis Longmont thought about closing his saloon and coming over with me.
Oh, well, I'm glad he didn't do that. Otherwise, I would have every beer drinker in Big Rock angry with me.
I see you still have your sense of humor about you. That's a good sign. It's a very good sign.
Smoke tied Seven on behind the carriage, then climbed into it to sit beside Sally. As Pearlie drove down the main street, people stared in amazement at the fine coach, wondering what it was doing there. Smoke waved at him with the back of his hand.
Smoke, what on earth are you doing?
I'm waving at the little people from this fine carriage.
Oh,
Sally, are you all right?
Oh, I'm fine. Just quit making me laugh out loud like that. It hurts. Oh, on the other hand, make me laugh all you want. I need laughter, and I don't care whether it hurts or not.
Soon, Sally was sitting in a rocking chair on the front porch of the house. Smoke, Pearlie, and Cal were hovering around her, offering to bring her coffee or tea, whatever she might want, a shawl, a footstool, something to read, something to eat.
Oh, for crying out loud, don't any of you have something else to do? What about the spring roundup? We do have a ranch to run, you know.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Right now, it seems like most of the work is finding cows and calves that's got themselves bogged down in mud holes here and there.
Oh, but we brung in some hands for that.
And we got calves to brand.
You're turning all that over to temporary help?
No, ma'am, we're gonna be out there. Someone needs to be ramrodding it.
By someone, you mean you?
Well, yes, ma'am, I reckon so. That is, me and Cal.
Let me ask you this. Do you plan to actually participate in the roundup? Or is it your intention to spend all the time here on the porch?
Oh, no, ma'am. We ain't going to be spending all our time here on the porch. Fact is, we're going right now. We was just wanting to make sure that if there was something we could do for you, why, we'd be here to do it is all.
Going to work would be doing something for me.
Well, yes, ma'am. What are you standing around for, Cal? We got work to do. We can't spend the whole day up here just hanging around on the porch.
I'm going. What I'm wondering is when you're going to get to work.
The two young cowboys continued their arguing all the way out to the barn.
You were a little hard on them, weren't you, Sally?
Well, come on, Smoke. You saw them tiptoeing around me, trying to wait on me like I was an invalid or something.
You are an invalid.
I'm not an invalid. I'm recovering from a gunshot wound. You've had to recover from a few, I recall.
Yes, I have.
It's a temporary thing. Besides, they need to keep themselves busy doing something on the ranch, so they won't be worrying so much about me. Especially Cal. Bless his heart, he feels personally responsible for what happened.
Cal feels responsible?
Yes.
Now, what would possibly make him feel responsible?
Oh, you know how he is, Smoke. He thinks he let me down because he wasn't in the bank when it happened.
That's foolish. No one expected him to spend every moment with you.
Well, of course it's foolish, but try telling him that.
Smoke walked over to the edge of the porch and stood looking out.
Are you enjoying the view? It is a beautiful view, I admit it. But I have a feeling you're trying to come up with a way to tell me.
Tell you what?
Tell me that you're going after them.
I have to do it, Sally. You know I have to do it.
If you remember, Smoke, that's how I met you. You were going after the men who had killed Nicole. I know you have to do it. And I know it would be useless for me to try and stop you.
The only thing is, I'm concerned about leaving you here.
Oh, don't be concerned. I'm going to be fine. Besides, I have Pearlie and Cal here to watch over me. What more could you ask for?
I'm going into town. I need to visit with Sheriff Carson for a bit. I'll come back here before I leave.
I'll fix a little something for you to take with you.
No, you don't. You stay right there in that chair, and don't even try to get up unless Cal or Pearlie are here to help you.
I don't know if you think I'm 3 years old or 93 years old.
Neither. I think you're wounded.
Dr. Colton laughed when Smoke told him that Sally had wanted to fix something for him to have on the trail.
She would do something like that. For anyone else with a wound that severe, they'd be soliciting all the sympathy and care they could get. For Sally, it is naught but a temporary inconvenience.
Smoke and Dr. Colton were in Longmont Saloon. Lewis was sitting at the table with them.
There's a saying I heard once. For one blood, I shall extract two. My revenge shall be severe.
At that moment, Sheriff Carson came in. He smiled when he saw Smoke.
I got it. Just came in by telegraph a few moments ago.
Thanks, Monty.
You got what?
I sent a telegram to Philip Wilcox in Denver. He's a U.S. Marshal for Colorado. He sent authorization to make Smoke a deputy U.S. Marshal. That way, Smoke can go after the murderers and thieves who shot Sally with universal authority.
Sheriff Carson held up a badge.
I keep a couple deputy U.S. Marshal badges in the office for just such a thing. Hold up your right hand.
Smoke repeated the oath as administered by Sheriff Carson.
Congratulations. You are now an officer of the law.
Gunnison, Colorado. Like many other towns in the county, Gunnison began its life because of the silver that was dug out of the nearby mountains. When the silver played out, the town survived because a railroad served the area ranchers. Like many western towns, it was divided into two sections, a rough collection of saloons and shanties, and legitimate businesses and homes. The Hard Rock Saloon was in the rougher section of town. Inside, occupying a table at the back, sat Bill Dinkins, Cole Parnell, Travis Slater, and his brother Frank. Parnell had been reading the newspaper, and he slapped it down on the table.
Son of a bitch, they know who we are.
Who knows who we are?
The law knows who we are. Says right here that the Bill Dinkins gang held up the bank and killed the bank president, some merchant, and the sheriff.
Don't forget the woman. Dinkins killed her, too.
She ain't dead.
How do you know she ain't dead?
Hell, because it says right here in the newspaper. Says she's recuperating just fine.
And that's probably how they found out who he was. She probably told the law everything.
And that ain't the bad thing.
What is the bad thing?
This ain't just any woman that you shot. Maybe you don't know it. But the woman you shot is married to Mr. Smoke Jensen.
Smoke Jensen? Well, that ain't good.
Damn right it ain't good. According to this here newspaper, he's done got himself deputized, and he aims to come after us.
Deputized? Hell, that don't mean nothing. All we gotta do is leave the county, and he can't come for us.
That won't work. He's been deputized a United States Marshal, and that means he can go anywhere he wants.
Yeah, well, if he does come after us, he just may be biting off more than he can chaw. I sent word for someone to join us.
What do we need someone else for?
We lost Putnam, didn't we? I figure on replacing him.
I knowed Putnam when we was in prison together. Gonna take a good man to replace him.
A man I've got coming is worth 5 Putnams.
Now who would that be?
You'll see when he gets here.
When will that be?
The train gets here, too. We got less than an hour to wait now, I reckon.
He stood on the platform for just a minute, looking around. Nobody came to meet him, but he wasn't expecting anyone. A child who saw him was frightened by his skull-like head, and he turned his face into his mother's skirt and clutched it about him. Harley waited on the platform until his horse was led down the ramp from the cattle car, then walked down to claim him. It took but a minute to ride from the depot to the saloon, where he dismounted and tied his horse to the hitch rail. He glanced up and down the street as if making certain there was no potential threat, and pushed his way through the swinging batwing doors. He was wearing a gun strapped low on his right hip, and once inside, he stepped away from the door so he wasn't backlighted. He paused for a moment. Only when his eyes were fully adjusted to the dimmer light did he walk over to the bar.
You know who that is?
Can't say as I do.
That is Wes Harley. I reckon you've heard of him, ain't you?
I heard him.
He's a gunfighter.
He's supposed to be fast.
He's not just supposed to be fast. He is fast.
I don't believe that's him.
What makes you say that?
Well, think about it. What would someone like that be doing here?
He's here because I asked him to be here.
What?
He's the one I was telling you about. He's the one I asked to join us. He'll be with us when we hit the bank in Crystal.
You really think we need someone like that to hold up the bank in that little town?
If people like Smoke Jensen are going to start coming after us, it would be good to have someone like Harley on our side.
Harley stepped up to the bar and slapped a coin down.
Whiskey. The good stuff.
Oh, sorry, mister. But you're just a little too late for any of our good stuff. That miner down there at the other end of the bar just bought our last bottle of blended whiskey. But I think you'll find our trade liquor ain't that bad.
Harley turned to look at the young miner who had just poured himself a glass from the bottle.
Mister, I'll be asking you to sell that bottle to me.
Friend, I've been busting up hard rock all week just to thinking about coming in here for a good bottle of whiskey. I aim to keep it for myself.
Harley put the money on the bar and slid it down toward the cowboy.
Mister, don't you hear good? I told you I ain't selling my whiskey.
Either pick up the money or go for your gun.
What?
I said pull your gun or give me the bottle.
I ain't even wearing a gun. What the hell you talking about?
You.
Harley looked toward Travis Slater.
You're wearing a gun. Give it to the miner there.
All right.
Travis pulled his pistol from his holster by thumb and forefinger, carried it over to the miner, and held it out toward him. The miner held up his hands as if pushing Travis away.
I don't want your gun.
Put it on the bar, then back out of the way.
Travis did as Harley directed.
You're armed now. Pick it up.
Mister, are you serious? You really aiming to throw down on me over a bottle of whiskey?
For God's sake, give him the bottle, boy.
I paid for this bottle, and there ain't nobody gonna buffalo me into giving it up. I don't know who you are, mister, but I ain't giving you my bottle, and I ain't gonna pick up this pistol.
Harley pulled his gun and fired. Pink mist sprayed from the miner's earlobe.
Give me the bottle.
With his left hand still pressed against his ear, the miner shoved the bottle down the bar with his right hand.
Here, take the goddamn bottle.
He reached for the money.
That ain't your money now. You didn't take it when I gave you the chance.
The miner stared at Harley through terror-stricken eyes. Keeping his hand pressed against the side of his head, he rushed out of the saloon. Harley picked up the bottle. Carrying it and Travis's pistol with him, he walked over to join Dinkins and the others at his table.
Now, thank you for your loan of the pistol.
He held the gun across the table, raising the bottle to his lips. He took a couple of swallows, then wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and looked over at Dinkins.
Hello, little brother.
Brother? You two are brothers?
Yeah.
How come you ain't got the same last name?
We got the same mama, but different daddies.
We think.
You think? What do you mean, you think? Do you have different daddies or not?
Mama was a whore. She didn't always keep track of the man she slept with.
When you sent for me, you said you had something in mind. What is it?
Banks. Starting with one over in Crystal tomorrow.
Banks?
You didn't think we was going to do only that one in Gothic, then quit, did you?
Yeah, well, I didn't know. I mean, the first one sure didn't turn out well, now did it?
Elko. Smoke had been on the trail for 2 days, but so far he had no leads on where the bandits were, or even where they were going. Smoke decided to get a haircut. He had to find someone talkative enough to engage in conversation if he was going to find out any information. He didn't know anyone more talkative than a barber. He wasn't in desperate need of a haircut, but he could use one.
Would you be wanting a haircut and a shave?
Just a shave. From the sign outside, you would be Max, I take it.
Yes, sir. Max Gibbs is the name, and this shop, such as it is all mine. And you would be?
Smoke Jensen.
Smoke Jensen? My, what a privilege it'll be to serve you, Mr. Jensen. Yes, sir, I have read about you.
The barber shop was very small, just barely large enough to accommodate the barber chair and a small, leather-covered settee where customers could wait their turn.
You'll be wanting to wash some of the trail dust off your face, I expect. There's a wash basin on that table there. Help yourself. That comes with the price of the haircut and shave.
Thanks. How much is a shave?
Shave and a haircut is 2 bits. But seeing as you're getting just a shave, it'll only be a dime.
Tell you what, I only want the shave, but suppose I pay you for both anyway.
Smoke flipped the barber a quarter.
Oh, thank you, sir. Here, have a seat.
Smoke took his seat in the single chair.
You just passing through, are you, Mr. Jensen?
Yes, I came through Gothic a couple of days ago. I guess you heard about what happened over there. I'm talking about the bank robbery.
Oh, indeed, we have heard about it over here. It was in the newspaper. hi, the lady who was shot. That was your wife, wasn't it?
Yes.
How is she, if I may ask?
Thank you for asking. She's much better.
Well, thank God for that.
I have.
You know, to those of us over here, that bank robbery and the shooting was particularly upsetting, considering the Slater brothers.
Slater brothers?
Travis and Frank Slater. They used to live here. They was our neighbors, you might say, and now they're riding with Dinkins. I don't tell you that as a point of pride, by the way. The truth is, them two boys never was no good. They was working for Chance Carter, the rancher just south of town. Mr. Carter had him a 15-year-old daughter, prettiest little girl you ever seen. Well, one day Mr. Carter and his daughter both turned up dead, and the Slater brothers both turned up missing.
So you're saying that the Slater brothers killed Mr. Carter?
Yes, sir. I reckon I am saying that. Of course, we don't none of us have no proof or nothing like that, but Frank and Travis Slater never was no account at all. Mr. Carter turned up dead, and them two no-accounts turned up missing.
Smoke nodded. This was a good place to stop. Max had just supplied him with the last two names of two people who were with Dinkins. Max stretched the chair out, used a brush to apply the lather, then a straight razor to shave him. When that was done, he wrapped warm, wet towels around Smoke's face. The deputy sheriff, Bates, had been waiting for just that moment. He walked into the shop.
Plan on staying in our town long?
I just stopped in for a shave. And that's about done, I expect. Wouldn't you say so, Max?
Oh, yes, sir. Just another moment to relax your face is all, I would say.
Yeah, well, here's the thing, mister. We got law in this town. We don't take the strangers coming in and breaking the law.
Have I broken the law by getting a shave?
It ain't the shave I'm talking about.
I see. And you enforce the law, do you?
I do indeed. You see this star? That means I'm a deputy sheriff.
Your mama must be real proud.
The point is, mister, I am a deputy. Being as I am a deputy, well, sir, that means I can collect taxes when they're due. And right now, you owe this here town $2 in taxes.
And why is that?
It's to pay for the protection we give you while you're here in town.
I'll protect myself.
Mister, you ain't paying much attention to me, are you? Now, I'm going to say it real slow, so maybe someone as dumb as you can understand. You owe the city of Elko $2, and I aim to collect it.
I told you, deputy. I don't live here. I don't plan to live here. And I don't need your protection.
Bates, there ain't no call for you to come in here and be talking to my customer like this. He told you he's just passing through. Now, why don't you just go away and leave us alone?
Stay out of this, Max, unless you want to get hurt.
With Bates' attention diverted by the barber, Smoke pulled the apron off. When Bates looked back toward him, he saw that Smoke was holding a pistol.
What the hell? You're pulling a gun on an officer of the law?
Maybe you didn't notice.
Smoke jerked the thumb of his left hand toward his badge.
I'm also an officer of the law, a deputy United States Marshal. And like I said, I don't need your protection.
Oh, well, you should have told me you was a lawman like me. Of course, being as you are a lawman, why, there ain't no tax due. Sort of a professional courtesy, you might say.
I accept your courtesy.
Smoke got out of the chair, put his pistol back in the holster, then turned to reach for his hat, which was on the hat rack in the corner of the little room.
Marshal, look out!
Smoke spun around, drawing his pistol as he did so. He saw Bates standing in the doorway with his own gun drawn. Seeing Smoke's rapid reaction to Mac's warning, the expression on Bates' face changed from one of triumph to one of shock. He thumbed back the hammer on his pistol, but it was too late. Hearing the shot, several people came running toward the barber shop. Smoke noticed some of the men had stars pinned to their vest or shirt, but he had no idea which one was the sheriff until he spoke.
Who did this?
I did.
Mister, you are under arrest.
I don't think so.
What do you mean you don't think so? Mister, you just killed one of my deputies.
Bates drew first, Sheriff Cooper. In fact, he was going to shoot Marshal Jensen in the back.
Marshal? What kind of marshal?
I'm a deputy United States Marshal.
Why would Bates try to shoot you in the back?
Bates was trying to make Marshal Smoke Jensen pay him $2 for tax.
Did the barber just call you Smoke Jensen?
Yes.
Well, Marshal Jensen, I don't know exactly what sort of scheme Deputy Bates was trying to run, but I assure you we don't collect a tax from people who were just passing through our fair city.
I didn't think you would. Thank you for the shave.
Hastings, get Gustafson up here to take care of this body.
Sheriff Cooper, I wonder if you could tell me anything about the Slater brothers.
Cooper invited Smoke to his office. He had photographs of Travis and Frank Slater.
These here pictures were took by Fred Dysart. He runs a picture shop here. This one is Frank Slater. He's the oldest.
Frank had a high forehead, thin hair, beady eyes, and a handlebar mustache. Cooper gave Smoke the second photograph.
And this one is Travis.
Travis had his head tilted to one side. He was clean-shaven, and his hair was combed neatly. Smoke studied the pictures for a couple of minutes, then handed them back.
Marshal Jensen, about Bates and the tax. We are collecting taxes as a way of raising money, but I don't know why he tried to shoot you. I ain't never authorized nothing like that.
You reap what you sow.
Yeah, well, I think we've raised enough money now. I'm probably going to stop it.
Alvin Marsh, the state attorney general, is a friend of mine. I'm sure that when he sends some of his people down here to have a look around, he will appreciate that you have stopped taxing strangers.
Crystal, Colorado. The Crystal River, a fast-flowing stream that broke wide over the rocks, set up a roar that could be heard 24 hours a day all over the town of Crystal. It was impossible for the streets to run parallel or at right angles to each other. The result was a swath cut by the river through the pass, along which a couple of roads had been fashioned. On either side of the roads, the buildings stood as if hanging on to the side of the mountain. An industrious town, supported by the silver that was extracted from two producing mines, the citizens were sure that someday Crystal would be one of the largest communities in Colorado, if not the entire West. Thaddeus Walker, Raleigh Jones, and Emerson Teasdale were having breakfast together at Wilson's Cafe. Businessmen, they were vocal advocates of the town, and so convinced of its future they were about to engage in a new venture. They were going to build a hydroelectric plant on the Crystal River. Bringing Crystal into the modern age of electricity would, they believed, not only bring about growth, but in short would survive far into the future, even if the silver played out. They had calculated it would cost $10,000 to build the plant, and they were putting in $2,000 each. As soon as the bank opened, they were going to present their plan to the loan officer at the Bank of Crystal to secure the rest of the money. A year earlier, Thaddeus had visited his brother in Appleton, Wisconsin, where the first hydroelectric generator had been put in use. He convinced Jones and Teasdale they could not only put in an electric power plant in Crystal, they could sell electric subscriptions for enough money to pay him back for their investment, then continue to make money for years to come. It hadn't been a hard sale. Jones, who owned the dairy, and Teasdale, a partner with Walker in a silver mine, were entrepreneurial enough to see the benefits. They walked into the bank to take the final steps to bring it about. Unfortunately, Walker, Jones, and Teasdale were not the only entrepreneurs with an eye on Crystal. There were five others who also saw Crystal as the key to financial windfall, though their entrepreneurial experiment was criminal in its intent. Dinkins, Harley, Parnell, and the two Slater brothers rode down the streets to the bank. Leaving Travis and Parnell to hold the horses, Dinkins, Harley, and Frank lifted bandanas to cover the bottom of their faces as they rushed in through the door. There were three customers inside the bank.
You three, down on the floor!
Frightened by the masked gunman who had just entered the bank, the three customers did as they were told.
You!
Dinkins pointed his pistol at the teller.
Listen real careful to what I'm going to say. I want you to empty your cash drawer, then I want you to go over to that safe, open it up, and give me all the money in there. If you tell me you can't open it, I'm going to shoot you dead. Now, do you understand me?
The teller, who was visibly shaken, nodded.
Now, empty your cash drawer into this here bag, then go over there, open the safe, and empty it as well.
With his hand shaking so badly he could scarcely hold on to the money, the bank teller did as he was instructed. When the cash drawer was empty, he moved over to the big safe and opened it rather easily. Taking bound packets of money from the safe, he dropped them into the cloth bag.
Don't go in there!
Dinkins recognized it as Parnell's voice.
What do you mean, don't go in there? What the hell's going on in here?
As Dinkins, Harley, and Frank Slater started toward the front door, distracted by the gunshot outside, Thaddeus Walker pulled his gun. He fired but missed. Harley spun around and killed all three of the bank customers.
Let's go!
Outside, the man Parnell had frightened off by a gunshot was running down the street away from the bank. The citizens of Crystal, who but a moment earlier had been going about their daily commerce, watched as five horsemen galloped out of town, firing their pistols indiscriminately. Most dived to the ground as the bullets flew, but a man stepped out of the gun store and, raising a rifle to his shoulder, fired. One of the galloping horses went down, leaving an outlaw without a horse.
No! Hey, wait up! Wait for me!
Those galloping away did not come back for him. Turning, he saw at least a dozen men running toward him, all of them armed. He threw up his hands.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot! I give up!
Get a rope! We'll string this old bitch up right here, right now!
No!
The speaker was Sheriff John Dennis.
We ain't gonna have no lynchings in this town. We're gonna try this man legal. Then we'll hang you.
The trial took less than an hour. The jury's deliberation lasted only 15 minutes. They found Parnell guilty of murder by association.
Get up. Present yourself before the judge.
Parnell and Dennis walked over to stand in front of the judge. Judge Norton took off his glasses and polished them as he studied the prisoner standing before him. Finally, he put them back on and stared pointedly at Parnell.
Cole Parnell, you have been tried before a jury of your peers and found guilty. Before this court passes sentence, have you anything to say?
Yes, Your Honor. I admit, I was one of the men who robbed the bank, but I wasn't the one who shot them three men. If you want to know who it is that done that, it was Wes Harley. Wes Harley did the shooting, and that's a fact.
Mr. Parnell, by your admission to being one of the robbers, you have just confirmed the jury's finding. For as Mr. Thomas pointed out, your very participation in the crime, during which someone was killed, makes you guilty of murder, whether you did the killing or not.
I didn't know there was any such law.
Ignorance of the law does not excuse you from its consequences. Cole Parnell, there are three families in this town who are today without the family head. Husbands and fathers, Thaddeus Walker, Raleigh Jones, and Emerson Teasdale leave a hole in our community, especially in their families, that cannot be filled because of the most evil deed performed by you and your cohorts in this dastardly crime. Therefore, Mr. Parnell, it is the sentence of this court that you be taken from this place and put in jail long enough to await your execution. At a time to be fixed by the sheriff, you are to be taken from jail and transported to a place where you will be hanged.
Pittsburgh, Colorado. After leaving Elko, Smoke rode to Pittsburgh, where he sent a telegram to Big Rock to check on Sally. He waited until he received a response.
I want you to fire both Pearlie and Cal. They won't let me do anything. I tried to bribe them by telling them I would make some bear sign for them, but even that didn't work. Be careful and come home soon. I love you, Sally.
Picking up a pencil and a form, Smoke wrote out the telegram he wanted to send back to Sally.
I have no intention of firing Pearlie or Cal. In fact, I'm going to give them a bonus. They're doing exactly as I asked them to do. I love you too, Smoke.
While Smoke was reading his telegram and writing his response, a new telegram came in. The telegrapher, his green visor in place, sat at the desk of the machine, writing quickly.
It looks like they're going to hang him tomorrow.
Hang who?
There was a bank robbery over in Crystal. 3 bank customers were killed.
Do they know who did it?
Well, they know the one they caught, the one they're going to hang tomorrow.
Who is it? What's his name?
Parnell. Cole Parnell. He was tried and convicted a couple days ago. I guess they held off on hanging him till they could get the gallows built, because it looks like they're going to hang him tomorrow.
Send this for me.
Smoke handed the telegrapher his reply to Sally.
And thanks for the information about the bank robbery.
When Smoke rode into the little town of Crystal the next day, the street was crowded with men, women, and children. He looked around until he saw the jail and walked to it. A deputy stood just outside the front door. He held out his hand to stop Smoke.
Can't nobody go in until after the hanging.
I'm a deputy United States Marshal investigating a murder. I need to talk to your prisoner before they hang him.
I don't care who you are. Sheriff Dennis told me not to let anyone in, and that's just what I'm going to do.
Is the sheriff inside?
Yeah.
Let's see what he says.
I done told you what he said.
The deputy went for his gun. Smoke had his own pistol out so quickly the deputy was startled. He stopped midway through his draw, and he offered no resistance as Smoke reached out to take his pistol from him.
What do you say we talk to the sheriff now?
They went inside. The sheriff was standing alongside his desk, looking down at an older man who was filling out some papers.
Here, what is this? Scooter, I told you to keep everyone out of here till the hanging. What do you want, mister?
It's like I told your deputy. I'm a deputy United States Marshal, and I'm investigating a case. I need to talk to your prisoner before you hang him.
Did you have to come in with your gun drawn?
Sheriff, yeah, I drawed on him first.
I see. Well, deputy, what's your name?
Jensen. Kirby Jensen. But most folks call me Smoke.
Smoke Jensen? The Smoke Jensen?
That's the Smoke Jensen, all right, John. It's been a long time, Smoke. How you doing? And how's your beautiful wife, Sally?
Hello, Judge Norton. Sally was shot, and the polecat you have here, and the others who were with him when he robbed the bank are the ones who shot her.
Oh, Smoke. I'm sorry. Did she...
Well, she's gonna be all right. But they killed 3 others in the same bank robbery.
Yeah, they killed 3 here as well. I was just signing the warrant authorizing execution.
That's Parnell in the back.
Yeah, you can go on back there and talk to him if you want.
Smoke started toward the door that led into the back, but then he stopped. He pulled his pistol from the holster and walked over to lay it down on the corner of the desk.
You forgot to ask me for that.
Yeah, I wasn't sure how you'd handle it.
When Smoke went into the back of the building, he saw, though there were 4 cells, only one was occupied. The occupant of that cell was sitting on a cot, holding his head in his hands.
Parnell.
Who wants to know?
My name is Jensen. Smoke Jensen.
I'll be damned. You're the husband of the woman Dinkins shot, ain't you?
Dinkins is the one who shot her.
Yeah, Dinkins shot her. He also shot the man that said he owned the bank.
What about Mr. Deckard and the sheriff? Who shot them?
Truth to tell, ain't no way of knowing who it was shot them, seeing as we was all shooting while we was leaving the bank.
Where are they now, Parnell?
You think you can come in here and just ask me to tell you where my friends are and expect me to tell you?
Your friends.
Damn right they're my friends.
I understand as you were riding away after the bank robbery here, your horse got shot.
Yeah? You thinking I'd be in here if I'd had my horse to ride?
Did any of your friends come back for you?
No.
Do you think any of them care now that you're about to be hanged?
I don't know.
Parnell, you don't owe them anything. And in another hour or so, it won't make any difference to you one way or another. As a matter of fact, nothing will make any difference to you. So, as one of your last acts, you may as well do the right thing and tell me where they are.
To tell the truth, Jensen, I don't exactly know where they are. But I know that Dinkins was planning on hitting just about every bank he could. Plan was to get a lot of money, then he's going to divide it up and we was all going to go off on our own. All except the Slater brothers, that is. I figure they'll probably still stay together.
I was told that 5 men robbed the bank here. But Putnam was killed back in Gothic, so that left only 4.
Yeah, that's right. And 4 is how many of us there was until Harley joined us.
Harley? Would that be Wesley Harley?
Yeah, you know him?
I know of him.
I bet you didn't know that he's Bill Dinkins' brother, though.
No, I didn't know that.
I figure most people don't know that, seeing as they got different last names and all. Harley's the one who killed all 3 of the people in this bank holdup.
Why did he shoot them?
One of them took a shot at us as we was leaving the bank, and Harley, he just spun around and shot all 3 of them. He's fast with a gun.
So I've been told.
He's damn fast. May even be faster than you.
Just then, Sheriff Dennis came through.
It's time, Parnell.
Yep.
Turn you back to the bars and then put your hands behind you.
Is there a crowd of folks to see my send-off?
It's gonna be a show, all right.
Jensen, I'm sorry your woman got shot. Was she killed?
No. She's going to be all right.
I'm glad about that. Listen, I'll tell you something else. You think you're just going after Dinkins, Harley, and the Slater brothers, don't you?
You mean there are others in the gang?
No, not exactly. But ever since that newspaper article come out saying you was coming after us, well, it spooked Dinkins something fierce. So, what he's done is, he put up $1,000 reward to anyone who kills you.
Now, how has he done that?
How? He just let it be known, that's all. Folks like us, we got our own way of spreading the news around. I guarantee you there ain't an outlaw in Colorado, Wyoming, or Arizona that don't know it's worth $1,000 to kill you. They'll be coming after you from everywhere.
It was late afternoon by the time Smoke reached the town that didn't exist prior to the arrival of the railroad. As a railroad town, it was growing so quickly it had already surpassed many of the older, more established towns that had been missed by the railroad. On the south side of the tracks lay the holding pens and feeder lots for cattle the area ranchers brought to ship to slaughterhouses in Kansas City and Chicago. The town proper was north of the tracks. Earl Avenue, the main street, ran at right angles to the tracks in a mostly unsuccessful attempt to get away from the smell and the flies of the holding pens. The town, built by merchants and businessmen, boasted a bank, 3 lawyers, a doctor, a thriving newspaper, a hotel, restaurant, playhouse, and 4 saloons. The stores and business buildings had not yet had time to become weather-worn and stood proudly along either side of the street with boardwalks connected one to the next so that even in the worst weather, pedestrians didn't have to walk in the mud of the street. Behind those were private homes where the townspeople lived. Most of the houses had vegetable gardens, but the tomatoes, corn, carrots, beans, lettuce, and cabbage plants were nothing but late spring green. A train sat at the Parlin Depot, and its presence had drawn several people to the station to watch its arrival and departure. Because there were so many people at the depot, the main street of town was relatively empty as Smoke rode in. Though it wasn't dark yet, the lamplighter was already making his rounds to provide illumination once darkness fell. Smoke stopped at the Silver Spur Saloon, not only for a beer to cut the trail dust, but also on the chance that he could pick up some news about Dinkins and the other men he was looking for. Because of his longtime friendship with Lewis Longmont, Smoke had the tendency to gauge all saloons by Longmont's. Nearly all the saloons he had ever seen came in lacking, but the Silver Spur missed it by a mile. Even in the nighttime, Longmont's was well lit. In this place, all the chimneys of the lanterns were soot-covered, so the light was dingy and filtered through drifting smoke. The place smelled of whiskey, stale beer, and sour tobacco. A long bar was on the left, with dirty towels hanging on hooks about every 5 feet along its front. The large mirror behind the bar, like everything else about the saloon, was so dirty smoke could scarcely see any images in it. What he could see was distorted by imperfections in the glass. A half dozen or so bar girls were flirting about, and a few card games were in progress. But for the most part, the patrons were just drinking and talking.
What can I get for you?
Beer, and a recommendation for some place to eat.
Got food here?
No, I have a hankering for a real sit-down restaurant.
Kind of a highfalutin fella, ain't you?
No, I just like clean food.
The bartender took a mug down, then held it under the spigot as he drew a glass of beer.
Now you might try the Parlin Diner. Folks talk high about it.
Thanks.
Smoke paid for the beer. Without turning away from the bar, he drank his beer and listened to the conversation going on all around him. When he finished his beer, he walked down the street until he found the Parlin Diner. After a supper of roast beef and homemade noodles, he took Seven to the livery to be put up for the night. Then he went to the Homestead Hotel. The lobby of the Homestead Hotel was well appointed with overstuffed sofas and chairs, a rose-colored carpet, and several brass spittoons. A few strategically placed lanterns provided light, if not brightness. The lobby was quiet and empty, except for the desk clerk who sat in a chair behind the sign-in desk reading a newspaper. The clerk looked up as Smoke stepped up to the desk.
Do you have a room that overlooks the street?
We do indeed, sir.
Good.
Smoke signed the register, and the clerk turned it around to read the name before he reached for the key.
Smoke Jansen? My, what an honor, sir, to have you stay in our hotel.
Thanks.
The clerk turned toward a board filled with keys hanging from hooks and took one down.
Your key, sir. You're in room 212. Go upstairs, turn back towards the street, and it'll be the last room on the right.
Smoke nodded and started toward the stairs.
Enjoy your stay, Mr. Jensen.
Rufus Barlow was sitting in the lobby reading the newspaper when he heard the desk clerk call out to Smoke Jensen. Barlow watched Smoke go up the stairs, then walked over to the front desk.
Who's that fella that just checked in?
Why, that was Mr. Smoke Jensen, staying right here in our hotel.
You don't say.
I do say. You want to see the register where he signed in?
The clerk turned the register toward Barlow, and Barlow read it, then smiled.
How about that? That's something, ain't it?
Mr. Barlow, may I ask what you're doing here? You never do anything except come into our hotel, or read our newspaper, and drink our coffee. I have told you that the lobby and the coffee are for paying guests, not derelict bums. Now, if you don't leave, I will summon the sheriff.
I'm going.
In Blakely Saloon, which was halfway up Earl Avenue on the east side of the street, Rufus Barlow sat nursing his beer as he discussed a plan with his partner. A plan that both knew could either make a lot of money for him or get him killed. Barlow's partner was a man named Murdoch Felton, but he had been called Slim for so long that even he had almost forgotten his real name. He fingered his mustache fitfully.
Are you sure that the fellow staying in the homestead is really Smoke Jensen? Or is he just Waycox shooting off his mouth?
Waycox was Jeremy Waycox, the desk clerk at the hotel.
It's Smoke Jensen, all right. I seen the register where he signed in.
Might have been someone just saying that's who he is.
No, I seen him go upstairs. It's Jensen, all right. I seen him one time at Colorado Springs. Didn't recognize him right off because it's been a long time, but he's damn near as big as a bear, so it ain't like you can miss him.
That don't sound to me like the kind of fella you get into a fight with. Yep, that's exactly what you're wanting us to do.
It ain't gonna be no fist fight. This here fight's gonna be fought with guns.
That's even worse. They say he's as quick as lightning with his gun.
Yeah, he is. And that's something I'd be worrying about if it was going to be a fair fight. Only it ain't going to be what you would call a fair fight. The plan I got laid out is foolproof.
There ain't nothing foolproof. Most especially when it comes to dealing with someone like Smoke Jensen. That man ain't even human.
What do you mean he ain't human? He's human just like everybody else. If you shoot him, he'll die just like everyone.
Then how come he ain't already dead? You got any idea how many folks he'd try to kill him?
Yeah, well, they just didn't go about it right is all. Now, we'll do it right.
How much money is he again?
There's $1,000 in it, Slim. 500 for each of us.
That's a lot of money.
You're damn right that's a lot of money.
All right. I'll go along with your plan.
As the ramrod of Sugarloaf, Pearly's duties were greatly increased during Smoke's absence. He had to supervise all the hands, including the extras who had been put on for the spring roundup. Cattle that had wandered away during the winter had to be found and brought back into the herd, and calves produced during the time had to be branded. He was laying out the irons with the /SJ brand when Cal came into the barn with a worried look on his face.
What is it, Cal?
She ain't got up.
Who ain't got up? What are you talking about?
Miss Sally. She ain't got up yet this morning.
Maybe she's just tired and sleeping in.
No, it ain't that. It's something bad. I just know it is.
Well, what makes you think that?
Because I stood outside her bedroom door and I called out to her. I called out loud, too. Loud enough to wake her up if all she's doing is sleeping. But she didn't answer me. Well, I'm worried, Pearly. I'm awfully worried.
All right, let's go see if we can wake her up.
Pearly, you don't think she's dead, do you?
They walked quickly from the barn to the big house.
No, she was feeling real good last night. You know that.
Yeah, and that's what got me worried. I mean, if she was feeling all that good last night, how come it is that she ain't woke up yet this morning?
Oh, you worry too much.
The two men entered the big house, then walked down the hallway to the bedroom that Smoke and Sally shared. Pearly knocked on the door.
Miss Sally! Miss Sally, it's Pearly! It's late in the morning now. You want something? Would you like us to bring you a cup of coffee?
The two men waited outside the door for Sally's answer, but no answer was forthcoming.
Miss Sally, are you all right? Me and Kyle is getting a little worried here. I mean, not hearing nothing from you and all make us feel a lot better if you'd answer us.
Oh, she's dead, Pearly. She's dead. I just know it. We was left to look after her and we didn't do our job.
Pearly tried the door, and finding it unlocked, he pushed it open.
You ain't going into the bedroom, are you?
Why not? If she's dead, it won't matter none. And if she's alive, then something's obvious wrong and she needs us.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right.
The two walked into the bedroom. Sally was lying on her back, covered to her shoulders, with her head turned to one side on her pillow. Pearly put his hand down in front of her nose.
She's alive. I can feel her breathing.
Miss Sally? Miss Sally, wake up. You're scaring us something fierce. Please, wake up.
Sally's eyes opened, but there was a glazed look in them, as if she didn't quite know where she was or what was going on.
Oh.
Pearly touched her forehead, then jerked his hand back.
What is it?
Her skin is hot.
She's got a fever. I remember Dr. Gunther telling us if she got a fever, we was to come get him right away, because that means something bad was happening.
Pearly turned away from the bed and started out of the bedroom.
Where are you going?
I'm going after Doc Colton. I'm going to send a telegram to Smoke.
How do you even know where he is?
Before he left, he made a list of towns he was going to and when he'd get there. I'm going to send a telegram to 3 towns, the one he was just at, the one he's supposed to be at now, and the next town on his list. He's sure to be in one of those 3 places.
What should I do?
I don't know. I'm not sure what should be done, but I reckon that if you kept a dampened cloth on her forehead, that might help some. And if it don't help, it's for sure going to make her feel better, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, good idea. I'll get a pan of water, and I'll be right here when you get back with the doctor.